I am Beverly. I like putting on shirts still warm from the dryer and the sound of heavy rainfall. I dislike seeing people riding bikes without a helmet on and settling for mediocre coffee. Now, there's nothing I can do about strangers forgoing basic bike safety, but ensuring that I never drink crummy coffee again has never been easier. I just get it through Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But what really makes them different is that they deliver this quality coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. And nothing will elevate your coffee game quite like starting with freshly roasted beans. Sparkplug will even take the thinking out of it for you by offering autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And for Top 100 Project listeners, Sparkplug is offering a 10% discount if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, the number 100. The discount doesn't apply to any of the gear Sparkplug carries, but it will apply to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So there's never been a better time to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Bonjour, cinema lovers, and merci for hearing us do the movie reviewing thing in our next 100 Project series. Don't despise us for spoiling this movie, because we will. Je suis Ryan Ellis, and here with me is my magnifique wife, Bev.
C'est moi.
C'est toi. So the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Amélie. One of my favorite moments in Amélie is when she wonders how many couples in France are having orgasms at that exact moment. How many is it?
I think it's 15.
You gotta say it like she does.
Can't. With a wonderful, fast-paced montage. Mm-hmm.
With some nudity, and that's what earns this movie its R rating. I don't think there's any other nudity in the movie, and if there is, well, maybe in the porn shop or Nino works.
Yeah, there definitely is then.
But basically, it's that one scene that earns the movie an R rating. And it's a fun moment, a funny moment. So the next 100 Project's 84th motion picture, Amélie, isn't American, so it couldn't be nominated for any AFI lists. The flick was shown at a slew of festivals throughout 2001, then was released stateside in November of 01. The French delight made $33 million over here, which is not bad for a foreign film. Bev, explain what the movie's about with us in it.
Audrey Tautou is the title character, a shy, imaginative, and lonely waitress in Paris. By chance, she comes across a stranger's lost box of childhood treasures and goes to some trouble to find the owner and return it, an experience that inspires her to quietly meddle in the lives of everyone around her with varying degrees of success. But can Amélie turn her do-goodery around to herself, overcome her fears, and pursue love with her equally quirky crush, Nino?
Yes.
Yes, she can. Of course she can. In a movie like this.
That's the nutshell. Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's actually, don't fall in love with a dreamer. Or do. Because they are both dreamers and they both fall in love. It seems, at least. Or maybe it's just lust.
Yeah, because they really don't know each other whatsoever.
At all.
Yeah.
They fucked happily ever after, I guess. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on the film. 89% of critics liked the movie, 157 fresh, 20 rotten, and 95% of audiences, so damn good scores. But it's also 80th on the IMDb's 250, which is a pretty good ranking for a movie like this on what is effectively a fanboy nerd type site. It was 71st at the 2001 U.S. box office. Harry Potter and the whatever stone, the Sorcerer's Stone, Philosopher's Stone, whatever the hell it's called, was number one. And The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, was number two. And we covered that one, of course, for the Top 100 Project, the very last Top 100 Project movie in that original iteration. So the movie is Le Fabuleux Destin d'Amélie Poulain, is the French title. Had to say that once, I won't say it again. What did you think of this effectively fantasy film that is based in reality, but it's pretty fantastical?
First of all, I have to call you out for not doing the English translation of the proper French title. We just got Boring Old Amélie, but the title translates to English as The Fabulous Destiny of Amélie Poulain. Mm-hmm. But my impressions of the film. Amélie lives in this very specific wavelength of guileless cheerfulness that is not my natural habitat. So there are moments in it that I just find totally insufferable, but I am definitely not immune to its charms, and it's a very overwhelmingly charming movie. I do suspect that when you talk about 95% of audiences love it, I bet that 5% that don't love it just hate it. Because there's moments where it's a little cloying.
What's your least favorite scene then? I'm guessing there's at least one that stands out above the rest.
I wouldn't say it's a scene so much as, and I hate to say this because I do love her in the movie, but I find like some scenes, Audrey Tautou is just too much with the cutesiness.
Laying it on a little thick?
Yeah, seriously. You have to suspend your disbelief to see this movie in many ways. There's all kinds of fantasy elements, but perhaps the most ridiculous fantasy element is that somebody who's this adept at performing cuteness is bad at making friends and getting a boyfriend.
Should be swimming in friends and, yeah, boyfriends.
She's a waitress, especially. She shouldn't have to seek attention and be weird about attention. She should have to fend it off, honestly. She's a beautiful girl, and then her charm is over the top. But there's just one too many times that she looks directly into the camera with that mischievous little impish look. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And the notion that she's just like, oh, poor me, I'm so lonely. I don't know, you got a lot going for you, so a tough one to sympathize with. That being said, I'm not going to sit here and pretend it's a bad movie and people are wrong to like it. It's completely delightful.
Well, as for the looks part of it, she's got the Disney thing of cuting it up by having giant eyeballs. Now, she can't control that. She's born that way. And Disney animators, of course, drew huge eyeballs on their characters. But that is one of the reasons why she stands out so much. The scene where she's about to break the, was it creme brulee or whatever it is? That's where she's holding a little spoon. That's not quite the poster shot.
Yeah.
It's not the poster shot exactly, because she's not holding the spoon.
But it is exactly a poster shot, as if they
not holding a spoon.
No, okay, no, I know. But my point being that they got her to stand in the exact same position. They shot her from the exact same angle. She has the exact same expression on her face. Her hair is different, and she doesn't have the spoon. But if you compare those two images, they're strikingly similar.
Before we go any further, we should probably acknowledge that you might hear some storms out there, listeners. It's our first possible winter storm of the year out there.
Yeah, winter is coming. This is the life of Canon. Yeah, we don't have President Trump, but we do have winter storms in November. Anyway, Amelie is unbearably, surprisingly, almost unrealistically adorable.
Her or the movie? Well, I guess the movie, too, because it's got the eye-popping colors. This is a great-looking DVD. We don't own the Blu-ray. It probably looks even better. I'm sure it does. I love the fact that it's got such great look to it. And they had to clean up the French streets a little bit, because I guess no city is as perfectly great-looking as this one is.
It's a fantasy version of Paris, and a version of Paris that probably has never existed, but insofar as people imagine Paris, it's a rather nostalgic view. Shops with the meat hanging in the windows, even the way she dresses, the way people are, and the apartment building, there's a lot of nostalgia in the film. And you talk about the color popping, it's not just the color that pops, they shot everything in this wide angle lens. And so when you talk about her big eyes and her cute face, when you shoot that with a wide angle lens, it just cutifies everything a little bit more. The movie is really trying to be adorable. And it succeeds.
It's very whimsical, but it's pretty dark to kill her mother, Amandine, with a suicide diver off a church.
It's true, there's dark moments. It's not just the sex in the beginning and the porn shop. Yeah, it's her mother's death, and some of her good deeds, they don't work, or they just cause more trouble. It's always stuck with me about the movie from the first time I saw it back when it first came out, that she sets up the tobacconist, her hypochondriac
Georgette
tobacconist.
And Joseph, yeah.
Yeah, and Joseph is clearly a problem man. Mm. He is stalking one of the waitresses there. His jealousy is toxic. He's not even her boyfriend anymore, and he still feels like he has this right to her time and her attention and to criticize the way that she moves and everything she does. His behavior is terrible. To set him up with someone else and to let him victimize two of the women in the restaurant just seemed like a terrible idea. And of course it just seems like her plan went off without a hitch, and they get together and they're happier for like 1 week before he does exactly the same thing to Georgette that he was doing to...
That's probably why the scene's in the movie, because it shows that she doesn't know everything and she doesn't fix everything. And she does con them into falling into lust, not so much love. They have that funny fuck scene where they're in the back. But it's a brief success. It shows that Amelie doesn't have it all going on. She's also got those Rube Goldberg traps where she gaslights the Collignon guy. It goes a little far. He's an asshole to his buddy, his coworker, his friend, whatever he is, brother.
It's his employee. His employee that he treats like garbage. It makes everybody uncomfortable.
But she arguably takes that a little bit too far, no matter how much of a dick he is. He's not that bad to the guy, really.
And it's just her luck that her actions ruin his day so much that he has no mental energy to pick on his employee anymore, whereas that could have easily gone the other way, and he could have, you know, been irritable from all these things going wrong in his life and taking it out on his employee. Made his life even worse.
Then there's her concoction of a game to get Nino his book back, and then eventually to, I guess, convince him to fall in love with her. And as we said while the movie was playing out, why are you not owning up to the fact that you're her when he says, are you her? You're her. You are. Come on. You got what you want. He's right there in the shop.
Because she's shy, and then she literally melts.
I like that moment. I like that moment a lot. That was really great. As far as effects go and as far as a touch goes.
In 2001, special effects had just taken this astronomical leap forward where you could do things like this believably. And Jeanette, the director, makes such great use of these effects where her emotions become metaphorically real, that she just turns into water and melts into a puddle in the restaurant. Or when she sees her crush, the little x-ray shows her heart beating. Jeanette, is that how you pronounce his name?
Jean-Pierre Jeanette.
Jeanette, okay, I'm saying it wrong. Jeanette. He has admitted in interviews that when he was a kid, he just grew up in love with cartoons. You can see that influence here. Even the way her mother dies, she looks like Wile E. Coyote waiting for the anvil
to fall. It's almost funny rather than tragic.
It is like almost humorous. There's lots of images like that that have a real cartoonish quality. But even like the best cartoons, even those that we grew up with as kids, can have this real edge to them like this movie does.
You say cartoon, makes me think of Ratatouille. And Brodotto, the guy who buried that little time capsule, he has a Ratatouille-like flashback when he gets the box of toys back from Amelie.
I don't remember Ratatouille well enough to...
Oh, it's not Ratatouille. It's the flashback. It's the critic. When he is fed the food Ratatouille, he goes back in time to when he was a child and ate this food. You don't like Ratatouille, as you said months ago in our Movies We Hate podcast.
Movies We Hate. I hate Ratatouille.
So you don't remember that moment.
Send your angry letters to @moviefiend51.
Yeah, you didn't do anything. You use this in a spark plug sponsor about a top three list, effectively. It doesn't carry through the whole film, but the likes and the dislikes of the people around her, we see that a lot in the first 20 or 30 minutes. It's a nice touch. I guess it's smart they don't overdo it, but they do kind of forget about doing it as it goes on. Maybe because we know all the characters except for Nino, and do we get one with him when we first meet him? Which is not obviously early in the film. It comes much later.
I'm pretty sure they did that with Nino. They have the introduction, like he gets the flashback of his childhood, of his little origin story. And I like the narration in general. I'm a fan of this style of narration. I know that you aren't always...
I like narration.
Well...
It was done right, especially. Andre Dussolier, or however you say his name. He's the narrator.
Oh, it's beautiful, too. Dussolier. I just love it. This film certainly didn't invent this type of narration. There was lots of movies that did it before. Water for Chocolate, or... You and I were just talking about this movie this week. A French-Canadian film that came out 1 year before this. Maelstrom by Denis Villeneuve. There's a great narration, like there's a series of fish that narrate that film, and they keep getting their heads chopped off. I don't know if you remember that detail. No. Similar tone to this film came out 1 year prior, so I wonder if there was some inspiration with that. Speaking of the likes and dislikes, the little one-off to give depth to each character, no matter how small they may be, just to learn one kind of random like or dislike that they have.
Yeah, okay.
I like that touch. Jeanette said that he had been keeping this little private project where he kept a notebook on him at all times, and every time something occurred to him as something that you liked, things that were just like a basic human experience, like she loves dipping her hand in the beans, and he kept a list, and then that was an inspiration for that element of Amelie. And one of the main themes in Amelie, the main theme being connection and the importance of finding somebody, whether it's a friend or the importance of loving and being loved. The other theme is definitely to enjoy the small pleasures in life, that is what life is comprised of. When I listed those things I like and dislike in the Sparkling Coffee, those are real pleasures that I take that probably aren't unique to me, but are unique in the way that they're free. They're just part of the living experience. I love that touch, and he piles it in the beginning of the film, but then I think it sets the tone, and there are reminders. You see her skipping stones. You see her dipping her hand in beans, and then the whole love story between her and Nino is wrapped up in his pleasure, which is collecting the photographs from the photo booth. I love that touch. I remember so much the first time I saw it, when the big reveal is made about who the mystery man is with all the pictures, and you just don't see it coming. Like, you really kind of believe that they have this fanciful ghost that's going to all these photo booths. When you learn that it's just the mechanic fixing the booth, proving that they work, and then throwing the pictures out, somehow It feels more magical. I don't know how they do that. Even though it's
such a plain answer.
But it's so magical that there's this plain, perfect, elegant explanation. And of course, you can't blame anybody for not thinking of it. But
it makes perfect sense.
I love that detail.
And she makes it happen by sabotaging that machine.
Yeah.
Because she knows who the guy is now.
So many moments in this film that she's just hoping that things work out perfectly as far as timing. Hoping that he can get coverage at work. At least they show the scene where he's like, I need somebody to cover for me at work. Mm-hmm. So I can suddenly show up at this diner at 4 o'clock.
All of this is set in motion by Princess Diana's death. That's when the cap on the perfume bottle rolls into the bathroom and knocks the little tile away. And she finds the box. And Amelie becomes a do-gooder slash meddler. Princess Diana, especially the last many years of her life, also became a do-gooder, more so than most royals do. So they are connected in some kind of ways, but it's not a huge part of the movie that it's Princess Di that's inspired this. In fact, obviously, most of the story is set in September 1997, because Di died on the late night of August 31st.
Yeah, there must be some intention of intertwining those two stories and incorporating a lot of people's reaction to Princess Di's death. The film was released in 2001. They could have said it any time, but they said it specifically during that time. And I couldn't quite put it together what the connection is.
She did die in France, Paris, so that's part of it, maybe.
That's right.
How about the traveling gnome, where she tortures her poor father? Why is this gnome in so many places?
The gnome that inspired the Travelocity gnome. There's so many little fingers of influence this movie has, but the Travelocity gnome is a big one because that came after the film, for sure. I remember being more charmed by it before Travelocity co-opted it and kind of ruined it. I remember the first time I saw this movie finding that deeply charming. Because the gnome, when they introduce it to the story, and she asks why he's putting it out in her mother's shrine, he admits to her, your mother never liked it. That's why I never had it out in the garden before. But he fusses over it, and he fixes it, and he varnishes it. So it's a symbol of him kind of reclaiming a life without his late wife. Because he's enjoying something that she wouldn't let him enjoy before.
And if he's not going to travel, then at least the gnome can.
But it makes him travel. The last thing we see is him with his bags packed in the taxi.
Yeah. Well, back to our main story. And that, of course, is the love affair. That's probably about half the film. Nino and Amelie start a love affair without knowing each other at all. And I'll quote a movie, and I forget where this is from, but I think they love the idea of each other. And if anyone listening can remind us what that movie is from, then please tell us. Because I know I heard that in a film, but I can't remember what it was. But yes, they are imagining these great things about each other that they don't even know for sure are true. They do have sex. And that's one thing I like, by the way, that's a nice touch, that she's not a virgin. It's a very good move to make her have had sex before. The look on her face doesn't say she's not into it, but yeah, one of those pats on the head, nice try, buddy, kind of deals.
It's like she finds the whole thing silly.
Mm. And she sort of looks like that with Nino after they've had sex, but not really quite the same way. She seems like she found the guy for her, but they don't have a real conversation. Most of their talking is on the telephone, and there's not even that much of that, and that's during the wild goose chase for his book.
He knows a bit about her because he knows she's the type of person who would have set up that elaborate scavenger hunt for him.
Mm.
And she knows a bit about him because she knows that he was game. She knows that he collects the photos. She's talked to people who know him. Oh, no. Her waitress friend took him for a walk and talked to him and made sure he wasn't a monster. So maybe that's a scene they included to reassure the audience that Amelie wasn't so off her rocker that she would just go to bed with someone that she really didn't know the first thing about.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they were just taking a leap and taking a chance. I think they knew a few more things about each other than you think, just through their interactions.
Their kissing scene is really well done, too. It's such a quiet moment. There's no music in that scene. Dead silence as she tells him, well, not literally tells him, but points where to kiss. Kind of like the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Kiss my oboe, kiss my eyebrow, and then, of course, kiss me in the mouth. This movie was released the same year as Bridget Jones' Diary, and those characters have a lot of things in common, especially charm. The actresses are both great in their films. I'd never heard of Audrey Tautou before, and of course, Renee Zellweger was not new to movies, but people probably didn't think she'd be very good Bridget Jones, and yet she was. Now, as far as Tautou goes, she's not been in that many other films. Da Vinci Code, of course, with Hanks is one of the big ones, and Dirty Pretty Things a few years after this. She was briefly the It Girl because of this film. But it could have been Emily Watson. The problem was she didn't speak French, and she was also tied up with Gosford Park, which is a better movie, actually. And she's great in that, in a smaller role, in a huge cast. But then I guess the Amelie movie is what can set you up for life. It just didn't really happen for Tautou. She's known, but she's not a big star. Maybe the language barrier is part of the problem. Although she speaks English, because she talks to Hanks in Da Vinci Code. So.
Yeah.
Matthew Kasavitz is Nino. He was in Munich a couple years after this for Spielberg. He also directed Gothica with Robert Downey Jr. and Halle Berry, and a movie called Lahain, which I guess translates as hate. That was in the mid-90s. I think I saw that a long time ago, but I know it was a very harsh kind of film. He's directed other things, too. And then her father's played by Rufus. That's all his name is, apparently.
Just one name.
He's one of the many people I'll now talk about who work with Jean-Pierre Jeunet a lot. He was in Delicatessen and City of Lost Children. Dominique Pinone, who played Joseph, the dick from the cafe. He always works with Jeunet over and over again. They've made films. Serge Merlin is Raymond Dufayel. I wonder if they're homaging the mentor-listener relationship that we saw in Three Colors.
Yeah, I can see that. I liked him. Well, I mean, he serves the purpose of allowing her to sound off about her loneliness and kind of explaining her behavior and why she's so afraid of talking to Nino. But then they kind of let him go off on his own tangent and then his own relationship with the shopkeeper.
He spends more time with the bullied shopkeeper than he does with Amelie, I think. On screen, at least.
And he's nice to him and mean to him. There's this weird dynamic with them that I just found, at the very least, unnecessary, and at the worst, confusing, and made his character inconsistent. When his character is just really there, I mean, we're talking about a fantasy film, he's an archetype, he's just there to serve the purpose of
the wise old mentor.
Yeah, exactly, who encourages her to break out of her shell, but also allows us to see what her real problems are, mm-hmm. what she's coming up against.
And Flora Guillet is Amelie as a kid. She never acted before this movie, and hasn't since. Just like Audrey Tautou, she's pretty cute, and I think she's effective in her small role in the film, so I don't know why she never got another role, but did not. Maybe doesn't like acting. That could be what it was. Jeunet did Delicatessen, which I've never seen, City of Lost Children, which I don't think I've seen either, but he also did Alien 4, Alien Resurrection, that is, which isn't really his fault, but it's not a very good movie. He prepped the movie for more than 25 years, and you mentioned the thing about taking notes, which reminds me of Guillermo del Toro, who also has a notebook that he's been working on forever. He probably has multiple notebooks, but it's all about movie ideas, drawings, and themes and theories he has for future films.
Yeah, that guy's always working.
Jeunet wrote the script along with Guillaume Laurent, who's a regular with Jeunet on writing stuff, and Laurent get credit for the dialogue specifically. The script was nominated for the Oscar. Not a lot of foreign films get nominated for writing Oscars, but this one was. And the producers were Claudie Osar and Arne Meerkamp van Emden. But it was distributed by Miramax, and that makes me ask the question, did Harvey lech out on Audrey Tautou? He must have.
Oh, he must have tried.
What do you think of Jeunet's direction? Did he keep the pace up well? The editor, by the way, was Herb Schneid, or Jeunet regular. Did they really keep it going, a two-hour movie that probably doesn't need to be 2 hours long?
You could trim some fat, for sure. For instance, the scenes between Raymond and the shopkeeper, right? But this is a visionary. This is the real auteur at work. I may not love everything about his style and his sensibility, but it's a tightrope to walk to make something that's this whimsical and not make it intolerable or childish. The degree of difficulty here is so high, and he created something special and unique and very timeless. I really think that audiences 20, 40, 60 years from now could enjoy this film on every level that we enjoyed it on. So it's not a masterpiece, in my opinion, but it's a really great film and something special.
And you're the one that chose this. You suggested we do this film in the fall. We had something else in mind, and then we said, yeah, let's go with Amelie instead, even though theoretically it should have been last year. It would have been the 15-year anniversary. But so be it. We don't always hit anniversaries.
It's just such a popular film.
Yeah, 80th on the IMDb impresses me immensely.
Even though it's a film that seems like it should typically appeal to women, and very few films like that tend to make the list on the IMDb because most of the voters are dudes, right?
Bro heavy, yeah.
I can see how this movie would appeal to men. It's like it's the Manic Pixie Dream Girl story, but told from the Manic Pixie Dream Girl's perspective.
And she's not really manic, but she is the Pixie Dream Girl for sure.
Oh, for sure. She's imaginative and silly and weird, and she saves Nino. So I bet there's lots of men in the world who wish they could be Nino and wish that there was this adorable French imp chasing them around Paris, mm-hmm. and concocting all these elaborate schemes to get their attention. I bet that that would be a delightful fantasy to indulge in. And so maybe it does appeal to dudes as well. I mean, I think a lot of romantic films probably appeal to a lot more dudes than people are likely to admit to anyway.
Some of the most popular films of all time are romance movies, and obviously guys like them too. Casablanca, Gone with the Wind, West Side Story. Those movies aren't just liked by women. So the film is 2-3-5-1. We watched the DVD. Cinematographer was Bruno Del Bono, who's got a lot of great credits, including Harry Potter and The Half-Blood Prince and Inside Llewyn Davis, one of the more underrated looking Coen Brothers films. It wasn't, of course, Roger Deakins, but it is a damn good-looking film in its own right. You agree? You're shaking your head yes.
Oh, yeah. You know I love Inside Llewyn Davis. Yep.
The composer was Jan Tiersen, who loves the accordion. If I could play the accordion and had an accordion, I'd be playing it through a lot of this podcast as background music.
The score is definitely appropriate for the film. And I read this great review by Tim Brayton, and he loved this score, and he was praising it, but he said this great line. He described it as belonging in a circus tent in some overheated Epcot Center version of France, as foreigners imagine it. Which is so dead right! But it doesn't matter, because this is a fantasy version of Paris to begin with, so you would have the fantasy version of French music.
Mm-hmm. It's Montmartre. Am I saying that right? Specifically, is that just a region of France or region of Paris? I mean,
I think it's a neighborhood of Paris, okay. Although I'm not an authority to say.
It's like Brooklyn with New York kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe. That is a real cafe, the Cafe of the Two Windmills, I think it was called. That's a real place.
Tiersen, by the way, is only composed for 6 movies, including Goodbye Lenin, which is a relatively well-known recent film. Well, not so recent anymore, but
another delightful 2000s. Foreign film.
Yeah, yeah, right. Amélie was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including for the script, the cinematography, the sets, the sound, and for foreign language film, which it lost to No Man's Land, which surprised me. But No Man's Land did win the Golden Globe, and I think it won some other major awards going into it. Well, there weren't that many major awards for foreign language film, apart from the Golden Globe and the Oscar. I've seen them both. No Man's Land's more important, and it's maybe a better film, but I was surprised Amélie didn't win. I thought it was just going to sweep to at least that one award.
You skipped past Influence. I want to talk about Influence.
I didn't really have that much, but okay. I didn't really have anything, but go ahead.
Well, I already talked about how it was maybe influenced by Water for Chocolate or Maelstrom. But after the film came out, they made a Broadway musical in 2016. It bombed. It had weak reviews and closed pretty quickly after it opened, like in less than a year. But maybe more important to fans of the show, if you've ever seen Pushing Daisies, then you can't deny there's a very strong and direct influence between Amélie and Pushing Daisies. And Brian Fuller, the creator of the show, said that he was a huge fan. That's his favorite film. And he actively tried to copy that style and feel when he created the show. It's a great show. It's short-lived, unfortunately. There was a species of frog that was named after Amélie. It was called the Cochranella Amélie. It was meant to honor the spirit of importance the film places on all the little details and how they're each important, just like each of the species are important components of their environment. And I know this is an influence because they came out in the very same year, but there are some really striking resemblances between Amélie and the Royal Tenenbaums. They both have this whimsical version of a very famous city. They both walk that tightrope between fantasy and reality. They're both funny and childlike, like a storybook, but truly dark when it comes down to it. They both have those great narrations.
Alec Baldwin's narration in that is one of the best ones ever.
Sets the bar.
All right, well then, short little podcast here. What are your last thoughts on Amélie Poulain and her movie, her fabulous destiny, all that stuff?
Well, it may not quite push my buttons, but I can't deny that it is a near-perfect execution of a style that's very hard to pull off without being overly cloying. It's a rare gem, and I'm glad that people enjoy it. They should. This is the type of film you cannot fault somebody or judge somebody for loving with all their heart.
I haven't seen this movie in quite a long time, and I enjoyed seeing it all over again. But I wouldn't call it great. It's just very good. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with being good. Nice little Pop-Tart here towards the end of the year. Here was a little souffle when the year's over.
This is an exceptional souffle, though, you have to admit. Oh, yeah. Souffle is not our favorite food, but for those who love souffle, I do think this might be a masterpiece of light, fluffy fare.
Okay, when the next 100 project hits the airwaves in a week, we'll really change it up and have a fiery review of a favorite of so many fanboys. We talked about fanboys in this podcast and everything. Well, how about Fight Club, which is way higher in the IMDb 250 than this one is. Man, my notes for the movie, we haven't even watched it yet, are already extensive, let alone once we watched it and I compile even more notes. So, the coming attraction trivia for Fight Club. There's no real right or wrong answer. Have you ever been in a fight? And if so, did you win?
So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Fight Club. And if you just can't wait that long to hear from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered well over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. Give us a rating, review us. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee. And don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It is not case sensitive.
So how many orgasms was it?
Cans. And cut.
Au revoir.